You're listening to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis.
Curtis, welcome.
Welcome, Joby. Good to see you again.
Welcome back to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis.
And boy, this is a show to beat all shows, I think. I mean, we've got all this new stuff happening. For those of you who sat down and thought you were just going to be listening to us for 60 minutes, boy, do we have a surprise for you.
You're stuck with us for 90 minutes.
90 minutes, and you better not go anywhere either. I'm telling you, when 60 minutes rolls around, you better be sitting tight because we're going for another 30 minutes, and we'll be going strong tonight for sure.
Yeah, so, we're switching gears tonight for sure.
So we're rolling out the new 90-minute show, and we're doing something that we haven't done before, and like just straight out distilled spirits. This is going to be something.
Yeah, there's been this whole week. Well, last week was kind of a barrel aged. A barrel theme was going on last week, and this week it's for sure spirits and definitely the distilled nature. It's been cool to, like I was telling you guys earlier, I've been on the search for these beer-based alcohols. I don't even know if there's a word for them or whatever it is, but basically these breweries that also double on the side of Ballast Point is one of the new ones that have, not a new brewery, but a new distilling. Rogue, I've had some of their stuff from there. Anchor, I think we had the Hophead vodka one time. That was really good. Mm-hmm. So from Hop. So it's really cool to see how these breweries are doing a second business basically by distilling the grain.
It kind of makes sense. I mean, you've got the facilities and to do it, and you know, I don't know, once we start talking to Alex about how much space it actually takes, you know, you look at you ferment it out, but then after you ferment it out, you end up distilling it and putting it into barrels. So I'm not sure what necessarily the I don't know requirements are for a brew house that's running a separate distilling kind of operation.
And we'll definitely talk to Alex about it, changing some of the legislation. That was a big thing that when we had James on the show and he was talking about, you know, hey, I can't have a tasting room. And these guys are kind of like going, hey, it's not fair. The breweries and the wineries get to do all this stuff. And how come we don't get to? And that's one thing kind of growing up in the business that I noticed, it was always different laws with spirits, and I never really understood it, and it was kind of like, I understand that they're higher octane, but why is it that they have to be regulated differently? It doesn't make any sense,
right?
Like, you know, you can store wine and beer at your house or in a garage, and you can't store hard liquor in your garage, and it's just like all these post prohibition I guess green laws, blue laws, whatever you want to call them. It's really weird. It's such a different law with hard liquor. But with some of the beers, Curtis, you had a 14% beer earlier, right? So some of these beers, they're not exactly light. It's weird to think, because if you look at the rules, 1 ounce of, or let's say an ounce and a quarter, a typical shot, a full beer, and a glass of wine, if you look at that alcohol scale from the DMV, it's all the same. Mm-hmm. So, you know, why is it? It's just kind of interesting to me. Why is it so different?
It's unfair. It really is. But to be turn mine up just a little bit. But to be fair to myself, that 14% beer, I only had 10 ounces of it. It was only 10 ounces, so I'm in good shape still. But good thing is we got like a pre-taste of what's coming up, and this is as smooth of alcohol as I've had, other than maybe like a 20-year scotch that I can remember. I mean, this is just blowing. Whoa, that's my headphone. Blowing my mind. So as we get going here, I want to tell, besides going to 90 minutes, we're having some headphone issues here, and we've got a new jack, and we're trying to get headphones volumes.
And our guest is running our headphones. That's terrible.
Right. I think that might be what's happening. But I'm trying to stream live, and so if you go to hopheadshead.com, right at the top of the page, you'll see a Happy Hour logo, and underneath it says Watch Live. So go ahead and do that. Now, this is broadcasting with audio as well, so you'll be able to listen to it. The audio is probably going to be really bad and echoey, so go ahead and turn that off. Go over to MyBuzz Radio, click the Talk button, Talk Shows, and then come on and then listen to us, and listen to us in full stereo volume, I guess.
Yeah.
And there'll be about a 4 or 5 second delay from what I say, and then like, so I'm waving at the camera if you can see me, and then about 5 seconds from now, those folks back at home will see it. But so you go ahead and give it a shot. You can kind of see what's happening in the studio. And then we've got a special Facebook giveaway. So Alex from Refined Distillery, who's our guest tonight, he has brought in a couple t-shirts. And so on our Facebook page, I wrote, I'm listening to Joby and Curtis right now on the radio, on My Buzz Radio. And there's a little link on it. So anyone who shares that link on their Facebook page will be entered into a drawing to win these t-shirts. We have two women's cut and two men's cut. So ladies, you've got every bit. You've got a great chance of winning, and fellas, you've got a good chance of winning some high quality t-shirts here tonight. So we'll go through, we'll listen. We've got a Harley driving by right now.
Yeah, it is downtown Ventura.
It is. So we've got
do we have going on next door?
The Majestic Theater. So we'll let you kind of register all the way through the show, and then at the last call, so around 8 o'clock, we'll pick a winner, and then we'll lead off on that into our next segment. So make sure you go like and share our stuff. So yeah, next door, the Majestic Theater, and we were wondering when our first concert was going to be while we were doing the show.
It's actually a film festival. That's cool, but. Oh, look, going back to the distilled spirits there, Curtis, I wanted to ask you, I'm going to sort of interview you now.
Oh, yeah.
What was your, what was kind of your first forte into the distilled spirits? What's the, do you remember?
Oh, it would have been vodka. Yeah.
Yeah. Just mm-hmm. like regular, just plain vodka name, like Ralph's vodka.
It would have been Phillips, most likely. Maybe, no. That's even given.
Phillips, is that a South Dakota brand?
That's giving it too much. Do you know Phillips, the brand?
No.
It would have been even worse. It would have been something called Gilby's. I remember.
Oh, I know Gilby's, yeah. They make a gin also. Come on.
I remember this very clearly, you know. So you could get a 750, maybe even a half gallon for $9. I don't know. So, I mean, that was, an alcohol that would go down like glass, and then leave you begging for mercy afterwards, you know.
So you didn't mix it with anything?
No, because I'm kind of, even then it was one of those things where I wanted to just, you know, man up and drink the alcohol, I guess. But I'm trying to think if I ever mixed things back then. You know, maybe like in a garbage can, you know, right. Like a party pail, whatever, where everyone dumps whatever they have in there. But
isn't that sad that that's our like first? I remember one particular stuff. It was called Aftershock. It might still be out there.
Is that a red hot kind of thing?
Yeah, you put it in the freezer and it basically crystals form, which is very scary. But crystals form inside, and the longer you keep it in the freezer, the more crystals form.
So it's like,
but you drink it
distilling.
Ice cold. Yeah, it's like freeze distilling exactly, and then you just pour ice cold shots of this like cinnamon deliciousness. That would just be like, it was terrible.
Yeah, I never cared for the cinnamon stuff. I mean, it burned as much, it burned enough anyway, and so why I would go and add something else that would add heat to it, I never did understand that one.
Yeah, it's the byproduct of growing up in a liquor store is there was always these little shooters. Different, like weird.
Tempting.
Like, oh, these are nice little, you know, we'd have a nice little shooter party. But yeah, I remember even drinking tequila, and you know, probably everybody has the same story, drinking it and getting too drunk, obviously, uh-huh. And then hating tequila for a while. But then about, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, I started drinking tequila again and tasting it. And I love it. It's just, especially because I love barrel aged stuff. And it was just like, oh, wow, this is, all right, this is not the same stuff I used to shoot when I was like, you know, 18, 19 years old going down to Mexico. But it's amazing how your taste changes and you can like go back to it. I thought, oh, I'll never drink tequila again. That's never going to happen. But when you get older and you start going back, and it's really cool now to go back and try all these things. Like I used to think of gin as, oh, yeah, gin. Who drinks gin? What is that? I don't even understand. And it's because I drank Gilby's.
Well, I ended up, I had the same tequila stories. And you know, yeah. In a couple of weeks, we'll have Montalvo tequila. So I'm looking forward to, that'll be really the first tequila I've had in, I don't know, 20 years. I mean, it's been a long time. And I just, other than if it was in a margarita, then, you know, I, And the only thing I can think of is, I mean, what the bad tequila was butter, you know, and I was like, oh no, I can't do that. And so anytime I would think about it, I would get that image and of me curled around on the floor and just going, oh, I wish I hadn't done that.
Bacardi rum, that's mine.
That's yours?
Oh man, you gotta stay away from that stuff.
That's
Bacardi
Alex.
Rum.
That's Alex.
Gold or light?
Light, actually.
is that sans coconut flavor, or is that
sans coconut? Just a little Coke, and we were good.
Yeah. So apparently, the zero calorie drink is Coke Zero and Bacardi Light.
Hmm. Oh man!
In case you want to go back to Bacardi,
right?
I did Captain Morgan for a long time. Captain Morgan and Dr. Pepper, which is a sugar and vanilla awesome overload, but that'll get you going for the whole night. But it's just fun to get back to look at distilled spirits now again and be like, wait a minute, this is a whole different story than
I know that
shooting and just trying to drink as many as you can as fast as you can.
And leading us into what we have, all this boutique, just beautiful stuff sitting in front of us that I'm really excited to. So we're going to take a quick break here, and then when we come back, we'll have Alex from Refined Distillery. We'll learn about what's bringing what's bringing these distilled spirits to our table, and why are they so good? We're gonna get to the bottom of it.
We're gonna find out all about distilling too, because I'm very curious.
Right. So we'll catch you in a couple minutes, and we'll be there.
And the beer I had for breakfast wasn't bad, so I had one more for dessert. Then I found.
You're listening to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis.
Welcome back. Welcome back.
There we go. All right. So my headphones have turned down now. Now we've got everything settled. Ah, perfect. Sweetness. So evidently...
Alex is our headphone management engineer.
He's got them right there next to him. What we're worried about, though, is after two or three more tastings, what's actually going to happen here. But so evidently it was Johnny Cash's birthday this week. Now, isn't he dead?
He's dead. Okay. He was a local
Ventura guy.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why it's such a big deal around here. I mean, you leave it to a newbie to go to.
I'm a newbie also. As soon as I moved here, I found that out. I didn't even know that.
And here I go and insult one of the greats of Ventura, and now everyone's going to hate me as I walk out the door here. But
we've got Alex here from Refined. Just like you found something, FIND, Refined Distillery.
Right, so refineddistillery.com. We've got a couple links on our Facebook page. So give it a shot, give it a look, especially go to the website, because the photography of the distillery, they're just beautiful photographs, first of all.
Yeah, and
so as we're kind of talking through and going through these things, you'll get a good idea, a good sense of what we're talking about. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks for running the headphones.
Yeah, oh, no problem at all. Thank you guys for having me down here. It's a real pleasure coming down to talk about something I'm so excited about.
Wait, you're excited about this?
Oh man, like, you know, this is like big boy toys when you actually come up and see the distillery. I mean, it's a functional piece of artwork. We kind of jokingly call it Willy Wonka's for adults. I mean, it is fantastic. So
right, you go. There's something about copper brew kettles and everything else, and not that you have a copper brew kettle, but your whole chimney, whatever, and you'll correct me all the way down. But you've got that's in copper, and then you've got the shiny stainless steel right next to it. So it is. It's everything that a big boy toy should have. It's all shiny and the best colors all the way around, for sure. So
how do we get to Refined Distillery, Alex? How does that happen? You've been in the wine business?
Yes. So, I mean, I can kind of give you a little background on me and how we got involved in this. My wife and I actually have been in the wine business now. This was actually our 20th harvest this last year in 2012. So we've been in the area for quite a long time. Actually, our brand, we were the 17th winery in Paso Robles. And, you know, now there are close to 300 wineries in the region. Wow. So we've been there for a long time, and we love the area and love winemaking. And you know, this new venture, we're actually the first craft distillery in Paso Robles, which is pretty exciting.
All right.
And we are we actually have a distillery within the winery, and we are producing 100% grape based spirits at this point. Though I say at this point because we will venture into some grain based spirits eventually, because I do enjoy a little bit of bourbon and whiskey myself. But the reason why we ventured into this is one of the things that as a winemaker we do is a process called signaying or bleeding. And all that, it's a fancy term for, you know, when we harvest the grapes, we bring them into the winery. The first thing we do is we actually stem in or crush them, and they go into a fermentation tank. Before we do anything else, a lot of winemakers, to increase the quality of their red wines, pull a certain amount of the juice off their red wines before fermentation. What that does is it concentrates that remaining juice with the skins, and a lot of the flavors come out of and color comes out of the skins. Mm-hmm. And so by reducing the amount of juice, you're getting better color and flavor extraction out of the skins. Unfortunately, that juice that you pull out, which arguably it's the free-run juice, it's probably the most valuable, the best flavored, is dumped down the drain, if you can believe it.
Oh, wow.
And you know, we're paying $2,000 to $3,000 a ton.
Right.
You know, farming 8 months a year and then throwing anywhere up to 50% of our work down the drain. For me, I was like, this is crazy. There's right. got to be something better to do with this. And I stumbled across the fact that you can actually make grape-based spirits. To be honest, I thought the only thing you could do was like a traditional aged brown brandy.
Right.
But I didn't know you could actually make vodkas and gins and just about anything out of a grape base. And so that's where the kind of the light bulb went on. And that started the clock ticking about 5 years ago, going through the process of getting our license and being where we are now.
Wow.
So normally, you would think of using the must, right? Or you would do like a grappa, like the pomace, I think it's called.
Yeah.
Forgive my pronunciation.
But that's right.
When I think of like a grape spirit, I think of that, the post, you know, wine production. What's left over? Let's make a grappa. Let's make something. Or let's give it to, you know, the guys that are working in the winery to make some liquor for them. Is this something new that using the Seigneur? Or is it something that you just kind of researched and said, hey, this is good juice that we can make something out of?
Yeah, you know, like you said, there's a lot of people when they hear grape base, they're thinking grappa. And there's a huge difference between what grappa is and what we're doing. Grappa is after you do the fermentation, and the base of the juice is fermenting on the skins. So after all the sugar is converted over to alcohol, then you press off what at that point is a finished wine, and then it'll go and age in barrels. But as a winemaker, you don't want to press those grapes so hard that you get every drop of juice out of those skins. Because if you press it that hard, you know, you could probably get, you know, close to 180, 190 gallons per ton out of those skins. But when you're pressing it that hard, you're also going to be pulling some of the bitter, harsh characteristics out of the skins and seeds.
Right.
So most of us, you know, probably on average get about 130, 140 gallons per ton out of our grapes. If you wanted to do a grappa, what you would do then is you'd take those skins and seeds, you'd put them in the still. A traditional way would be to infuse it with steam to basically boil out every last drop of alcohol out of those skins and seeds. But what you're also getting is you're pulling out those kind of coarser tannins, and that's what gives grappa that firewater characteristic.
Yeah, it's definitely a scary term. It's like, oh, grappa, I don't want it. Right. That's firewater.
It is firewater. But that's what makes grappa grappa.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and when it's well done, I mean, you can have some fantastic grappas.
Right.
But you got to pay for it because it takes so much work to get that last little bit out.
Right.
But what we're doing is we're taking that free run juice from the very beginning, and so we're talking about, you know, juice that is going into wines that, you know, arguably are getting some of the top scores in Wine Spectator and Wine Enthusiast. So these grapes are grown for premium quality wines, and we're taking that base material, and I always use the analogy like cooking. If you can start with an incredible base material, it's a lot easier to make a great product. And so we're starting with arguably some of the best grape base material, and gives us the ability to really make a truly fantastic spirit. And the reason why we, you know, decided on refined is we're finding a use for something that's being wasted and mm-hmm. refining it into a top shelf spirit. So
yeah,
that's very, where the name came
very
from.
Very cool name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm coming from a background that I don't even have a clear concept of what constitutes a vodka, and so that's what we're drinking now. And you're right, this is so much different than what I remember any vodka ever tasting like. I wonder if you can start with what is a vodka first of all, and maybe in a traditional sense, and then what you're doing, how that ties into it, and then why is this one so much smoother than what, you know, kind of lead us through that.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's actually probably one of the most common questions I actually get, because we actually do have a tasting room right there at the winery, and so people can come in and try the spirits. And most people walk in and go, wait, you can't do that. It's got to be a grain or a potato, whatever most people think. Vodka is really not what the material that you start with. But it's all about the process of distilling, at least in the eyes of the government. So if you can ferment it and create a base alcohol, you can make a vodka out of it. what really defines a vodka in the eyes of the government is when you're distilling it, whether you distill it one time or 100 times. When the alcohol is coming out of the still, it has to cross 95% alcohol to legally become a vodka. So every alcohol that you see that says vodka on the shelf in a grocery store or wherever has at one point been above 95%. And then the producer will add water to bring it back down to that 40% alcohol. And so it's that point at distillation that gets above 95%, which defines it as a vodka. So you can really, I mean, you could have, I mean, I've heard of crazy things like seaweed and, you know, obviously grain and potatoes. We have grapes. There's honey. There's all sorts of different vodkas out there. The reason why potatoes and grains are probably the most common is they grow in such a wide range of climates. Mm-hmm. Grapes are extremely finicky. They're extremely expensive to farm. If I actually had to go out and buy grapes specifically to make my vodka, I'd have to charge $200 or $300 a bottle just to break even. Yeah. But because this is material that we're throwing away, and a lot of wineries are throwing away, we're able to get it, you know, pennies on the dollar at this point. And it's cool because a lot of these wineries are just throwing this stuff away, and so now they're getting paid for it. Mm-hmm. And then also, when you dump it down the drain, it's not good for the drain. It's not good for the soil if you dump it on the soil. And so everybody's winning. So they're getting paid. They're not having to deal with a problem, and we're getting a great base material for a cool product.
That's great. So yeah. So vodka is an alcohol percentage, vodka is an alcohol percentage, and once it hits that, then any distilled spirit at that point is.
It can legally be a vodka.
Okay. So it's kind of like, so I'm coming, just equating it to beer, where like a Bock is something that's 6.5%. People who think a Bock is necessarily a big malty beer, but it's more of an alcohol content, and right. A Doppelbock is 7%. So it's in that range. So if it's going, so that's kind of what you're saying, is that if it's below that, then it can't be considered a vodka.
Correct.
Okay.
And we will probably deal with that a little bit, because we actually, as a winery, we're playing around a little bit, actually selling it through the winery as a brandy. And our brandy technically isn't a vodka. And that really gets into what really a vodka is. If you actually asked a distiller what a vodka is, a distiller would tell you a vodka is basically you're isolating the best alcohol that you can out of whatever you're fermenting. And so, and the best alcohol in vodka is the ethyl alcohol. That's really what you're trying to isolate. And so a distiller is going to tell you a vodka is basically the cleanest ethyl alcohol that you can produce from whatever the base material you're getting. So, if you're talking to a distiller, the definition of vodka is going to be different than whether you're talking to a government official. So,
right. So, can we talk about distilling just for a little bit?
Absolutely.
I mean, obviously, we're going to talk about distilling, but
yeah.
I hear a lot when you think of moonshine. Mm-hmm. People always tell you got to be careful with moonshine because they may not take the best cut of alcohol out of it.
Yeah.
And you hear a lot about the first cut, the last cut, and then the middle. Is the middle the sweet spot? Are we really looking for is there a name for the middle? Am I just making up middle? Or?
No. So the common names are basically heads are the first part that comes off. Hearts are the good part. That's that middle cut. And then the tails are the final alcohols. And basically what those really constitute are the different alcohols that you're trying to distill and isolate. And each one of those alcohols has different boiling points. And so we use heat to boil off these different alcohols at different points and isolate them and basically try to focus on the good ethyl alcohol. Funny bit of trivia, you know, you'd say watch out for moonshine.
Right.
Do you know what the cure for methyl alcohol poisoning is?
No. Was it ethyl alcohol?
Ethyl alcohol, exactly. So they're going
to... That was a lucky guess.
It's a little more booze.
That's exactly. Booze, so get yourself a methyl alcohol, and they're going to take you to the hospital and give you a little ethyl alcohol.
That's crazy. So ethyl alcohol is vodka, is the alcohol that we're
drinking. That is the main alcohol that you're trying to isolate.
So is the head really that bad for you?
The heads are really bad.
Make you crazy?
Yeah, and you know, depending on which base material you start with, like because we're starting with grapes. Grapes produce very small amounts of methyl alcohol, ethyl acetate, acetone, especially if you're, you know, I've been making wine for 20 years. Winemaking is, you know, I've been doing it for long enough. I can make a really good wine. And so if you do good winemaking practices, you can make a wine without a lot of these off characters. And so those heads, the first alcohols that you boil off and the first compounds that you boil off, and the common ones are the ethyl acetate, the acetone, methyl alcohol. I mean, it's a nasty cocktail. You don't want it. And so when you're talking about like Ghibli's or any of these kind of the cheaper alcohols, the thing about distilling is you're trying to isolate the good alcohol. So you're starting with a large volume and bring it down to a small volume. And if you're only selling it for, you know, a few bucks, you're going to keep a lot of those bad alcohols in there as much as you can without kind of spoiling the aromas. And it's even worse than gin because they can hide those bad aromas. But never buy cheap alcohol. It's not good for your body. But yeah, so we're trying to isolate the ethyl alcohol, which is that middle boiling point alcohol. And we actually, moonshiners don't have the benefit of some of the really good stills. They use a pretty basic kind of style of still, right, where, you know, there's a whole new artisan movement in the U.S., and actually Europe has been doing it for a long time, where you use a lot of the plate technology so you can actually really fine-tune the alcohols that you're removing. And so what you're seeing is just a whole revolution in the quality of spirits that you're getting.
That's really good. So essentially, are you... You're boiling.
We're boiling. And so we are using the different boiling points of the different alcohols to separate them. And, you know, if you go online and take a look at our still.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's
beautiful. It, almost there's one picture, and it has the little portholes on. There's about 13 portholes that go up the column. And behind each one of those little portholes is, it's called a plate, but it's actually more like a bowl. And what we're using is the plate technology to help separate and separate out the bad compounds in the wine, and also kind of stretch out the boiling points. And how that works is, as the alcohol vapors come across on the top of that column, they actually hit something that's called a deflagmator. It's basically like a pre-condenser. So there's cold water that we can run through that. So as the alcohol vapor goes up, it hits that cold water. The cold water acts like a dam, and it's forced to condense and fill a little bowl behind each one of those windows. Once each one of those windows is filled, or the little bowls is filled, or called, we call it stacked, then we actually turn the water down on that condenser on the top of that column. So if the vapor reaches that point, it can get across to the final condenser. But to get there, it's forced to condense in each one of those bowls of liquid and redistill. And so as it's going up that column, it's a continuous redistillation, condensation, redistillation, condensation. And it does a couple of things. One, it gets rid of the bad things, but it also raises the alcohol to a high enough level and stretches out the boiling points that we can make really clean cuts, getting rid of the bad alcohols and really just focusing on the stuff that we want. And for vodka, you're obviously looking for the cleanest alcohol, but say something like a gin or a whiskey, you do want some of those kind of things on the fringes, because a lot of the flavors for the whiskeys or gins or stuff like that, they're the cogeners that are actually around kind of just right on the edge of either side. And so we actually use the smaller column on the side of that that has the same technology but not quite as much of those plates to be able to kind of isolate those really good aromatic compounds that we want.
So you were talking about the heads in is there, you know, you're saying acetone and some of these other words that I when you walk into a pharmacy, you'll see fingernail polish remover, which is acetone. So is there a secondary market for you with those, or what do you do with it? I mean, do you turn around and get and sell?
He never has to buy a polish remover.
Well, and sell it to Curel or whoever it is. You know, I mean, what do you do with the heads, I guess?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because the reason we started this was to be sustainable and not basically throw away a resource. Mm-hmm. And so I've gotten that question a lot. And to be honest, we save some of it because as a winemaker, one of the things that we do, wine and beer is actually even worse, is it's all of a cleanliness issue. And so you're always cleaning stuff. One of the things we use in the winery for cleaning is basically Everclear. It's basically, you know, high enough proof that you can spray it on something. It'll dry real quick, but it's a great sanitizer. Well, I don't have to buy Everclear anymore because
you got your own Everclear.
I got my own sanitizer. But to be honest, the heads, because it's a lower boiling point, there's not enough ethyl alcohol in it to make it worth distilling. And so to be honest, we quantify it because the government wants to know where everything goes. Mm-hmm. And literally a lot of it just gets dumped. And and so that's one part that just disappears.
Okay.
The hearts, obviously, we save. And then the tails, which are the higher boiling point alcohols, those actually we save. They really never go away. They just kind of continually get redistilled. Because it's a higher boiling point, there's a lot of ethanol that will actually stay in that section. And so we really never want to get rid of it because it's pretty valuable because there's still a lot of ethanol in it. It just takes further refining to get it out. And for us, you know, we're fortunate. We're small. We have the ability to sell direct through the tasting room. It's all about quality for us. I mean, it's the way we do our wine. It's the way we're doing our spirits. It's not about a volume. We're not going to be a Grey Goose. We're not going to be a Smirnoff. You know, if we get to 2,000 to 3,000 cases, that's, you know, I'd be perfectly happy. And so for me, I'd rather build my reputation on absolute quality. Mm-hmm. And so we're really focusing on the cleanest cut. We probably overdo it, to be honest. So.
All right. So we've got we've got the vodka in front of us that we've been tasting. And so kind of talking through, this is the heart then out from that distillation process. tell us about the vodka and the process for this that we haven't covered yet.
Yeah. So, so as I said earlier, so we pull the juice off of our red wines to increase the quality of our red wines. Once that juice is pulled off, the Saignée is actually put in an independent tank. We ferment it just like we do a wine. So we add yeast, it goes through its initial fermentation. Being a winemaker, that's important because you have to have a clean fermentation. I mean, it's you don't want to distill something that has off aromas. So we are very careful with our initial fermentation of that juice bleed. So once all the sugar is converted over into alcohol, which generally we end up in a range of about 16% alcohol, it hasn't been fermented on its skin. So at this point, it's kind of a pinky wine. It's it's a rosé. But distilling is different than wine. Once you actually finish that initial fermentation, you don't want to throw it in barrels. You don't want to add SO2 to it. You don't want to do anything other than get it in the still as quick as you can. It's really important to get the base spirit up in alcohol as fast as you can to stabilize it. Anything you add to it, like especially like sulfur, it's going to basically magnify if you put it through the still. We actually did an experiment with some old barrels just to see what would happen with an older wine. And we tried to drop out all the SO2, but even with that, you still got an incredible, almost like a matchsticky characteristic that it was unpalatable. I mean, you wouldn't even get close to it. So for us, you want to get into the still as fast as you can. You take the wine in, you put it in the kettle, which is, if you're looking at the picture, it's the unit on the far right with a little silver kind of hatch on it. We use steam to boil it, and then it comes across directly to the stainless steel column on the far left, which is basically a condenser. So if you've ever seen like a hillbilly still, it's the copper coil that sits in the cold barrel of water. And so all we're doing in that first distillation is getting the alcohol up high enough to stabilize it. We're collecting everything that comes out. So we're not doing any cuts on that first thing. We collect all the methyl, the ethyl acetate, acetone, ethyl alcohol, fusel alcohols, everything. But when it comes out, it's coming out at about 40 to 45% alcohol in that first run. It's called a stripping run, the beer run. There's a lot of different names for it. But it gets the alcohol up enough where it's stabilized. Then you can set it aside. We can finish up our wine harvest and then focus on the distilling after harvest is over.
Okay. And it's clear at that point?
It is generally clear unless you haven't been paying attention. And every once in a while, you get a little boil over and it comes across.
You get a little pink.
I think I told you this last year, we actually did about 10,000 gallons of wine that we converted over. And to be honest, you kind of, in the initial distillation, it's not quite as important if you do get a little spillover, we have three more distillations after it. So it was more about getting the volume through as fast as we could. And so every once in a while you'd get a little color that would kind of bleed across, but it's virtually clear at that point.
Right.
Once that first run is done, then we actually, as I said, we do three more distillations, and it depends what we're producing at that point. But the vodka you're trying will actually go through the tall column three more times.
Wow.
And so in those three times, we're basically removing any heads and any tails and just collecting that ethyl alcohol. So the second time through the still, as I said, the first time it comes out at about 45% alcohol. We put that 45% alcohol back in. It comes out between about 93 and 95% alcohol. We add water back to it, put it back in the still again, run it through one more time, do the heads and tails separation, add water to it again, and then do that one more time. And to be honest, we're probably overkilling. We could probably do it in two, but it's one of those things. As I said, I want to make a top shelf spirit that is really clean and has got a neat characteristic to it. The neat thing about this, and if you were here smelling it, you could almost, there's a neat aromatic character to it that is very unique to grapes. And there's also a sweetness that we were talking about before we went on the air. And that's really something unique to a grape-based spirit. And it has to do with a chemical called glycerol that's actually produced in the initial fermentation of wine that actually forms a bond with the alcohol and comes across in the distillation. Glycerol, actually its boiling point is a lot higher than the boiling points of alcohol, so it forms an isotrope and comes across and gives these spirits a nice soft finish, which is pretty unique. I mean, it's so important that sometimes grain or potato-based vodkas will actually add a little glycerol in, trying to soften that sharp edge that sometimes they get.
Yeah, this definitely has no sharp edge.
Well, no.
Not even close.
Right, and I was going to say that's the perfect explanation or description of it too, is soft and even as it's going through, there's no burn, there's no splash in the back of your throat, that kind of, and even exhaling after you have a mouthful, sometimes when you exhale on something, it'll come through your nose and you can almost feel the burn vapors that way too, but there's nothing of that, there's nothing like that that's coming through on this.
Yeah, it's almost, if you gave it to me and my eyes were closed, I probably wouldn't guess it was vodka.
No.
I
mean,
maybe, I don't know, but if you just said, hey, what is this? Because it's got, it actually almost has an aromatics of almost a gin. I don't want to say gin because it doesn't have all the botanicals, but it has that flavor of something like, you're like, what is this? What's going on? And it's amazing. And that's, you think that is due strictly to the grapes?
I think it's strictly due to the grapes. And another thing, you know, you hear in the spirits world and about the filtration processes that everybody uses. And, you know, whether it's, you know, four times carbon filtered diamonds or whatever they use. You know, with my winemaking background, you know, when we filter in a winery, there's main issues that you do it, and it's generally stability issues or clarity issues. Spirits are inherently stable. I mean, nothing's going to spoil them. Clarity, you know, you could filter for that. To be honest, when you're careful, there's really not a real big issue to do it. So the only reason you would actually want to filter something, and especially carbon, is carbon removes aromas. And so if you're carbon filtering, you're removing aromas. But if you had good aromas, why would you want to remove them?
Right.
And so as a winemaker, when I'm making wine, I'm making that decision. I'm not going to filter this because it's stable. If, you know, I have an instability, I'll filter it. So I did the same thing with the spirits. And I said, you know what? This has got an incredible aromatic characteristic to it. It's got nice flavors to it. It's got a mouthfeel that it's unique. And so by filtering it, I'm only going to basically degrade the quality. And there's no reason to do that.
Right. It's almost like if you would just distill it right in the beginning, you don't have to filter it, so you don't have to cover up for it. But one, you said this is three times distilled.
It's actually four times distilled.
Distilled. One of the things I remember learning, just kind of in the business, not really in a book or anything, is that three or four times, can you get any more pure than that? Is that a wife's tale, or is that true? Like, because you have vodkas that claim 7, 8. I think I saw one the other day. It was 10 times distilled. At that point, are you just really not doing any? Are you getting any better at that point?
You know, if you made good clean cuts in the second time, you probably don't even need to do more, to be honest. For us, it's, you know, we want to be overkill. We want to make sure it's the best. And, you know, you say 10 times distilled. If you actually look at the technology we're using with the plate still, a single pass through the still and through that column is technically 13 times distilled. And so by passing it through that column three times, you know, that's 39 times plus the initial one. So we're 40 times distilled if you really wanted to add it up.
So now I'm even more confused.
So that's probably what they're saying is that they've got the 10 plates and 10 that's times, what they're calling.
Yeah.
That's what
they're, okay. Yeah, because and filtering, that's funny too, is you have diamond filtered, you have, you know, just all these crazy filtration systems. And those vodkas are $100+. I mean,
absolutely.
It's pretty insane.
There better be some diamond dust in that thing.
There's absolutely no diamonds. And they're grain based, which is the hilarious part.
Goldschlager. Some gold flakes in their gold leaf.
I mean, I would want to just drink this pure. I think we talked earlier, a splash of tonic, you said, something good like a Fever Tree or a Q.
Yeah.
But I think just by itself, how do you feel about temperature with vodka? Do you like a little cold, or is that, are we masking flavors again?
Yeah. Again, that's actually interesting you say that, because in the tasting room, I serve it at room temperature. Temperature is something that can disguise flaws. I mean, it is like in a wine. If you have a wine that's got off,
you got a bad Chardonnay, just put it in the freezer.
Absolutely. So it's the same with spirits. And so I want people to try this at room temperature, because I don't want to hide anything. To be honest, I would serve it a little bit more chilled. And if I had like a dry martini or something like that, I would give it a little shake on ice or something like
that.
Because
nice.
I do like it chilled, and it's refreshing for me too. And to be honest, I don't think it needs to, because I think it's smooth and soft enough.
You drink it right out of the bottle. It's dangerously smooth. Let me just say that.
It is.
So I'm drinking my second little. I poured just a little, because this isn't like our beer and wine tasting shows. But all by itself, not chilled. A little tonic, maybe that would be really cool.
Yeah, it's actually funny you say that, because you were talking about earlier about volumes. So because we have a tasting room for wine and spirits right next to each other, people walk into the back where we're actually tasting the spirits, and you could tell they're like, "Oh God, I can't do that, man. I have to go to another winery."
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't want to tell them that the 16-17% alcohol Zin that they just tried an ounce of, if you actually extrapolated out the quarter ounce of spirits, they tried more in that Zin than they're going to try in the vodka. So it's kind of deceiving. I mean, if you just take it in moderation, it is dangerous, because it goes down so easy, though.
Yeah, it is deceiving. I think we all have like this standoffish thing about spirits, like, oh my God, I'm going to get so, you know, like. But I think if you respect and in moderation, definitely. I mean, I love a good dry martini.
Well, and I think, you know, the advent of boutique distilleries, the same way as craft beer and wineries too, where people are more interested in the flavor and the moderation of it than because nobody's going to buy that bottle there when and to go throw it down when they can, you know, get in one that's next to it or down the road
Gilby's.
For for $5, you know. I mean, that's there's two different drinkers, you know, and so this is definitely worth whatever it is. I don't even know what it's retailing, but it's definitely
how much would we pay for it?
It's only $35.
Oh,
that's a bargain.
That is a bargain, actually.
Yeah,
for
right,
just by looking at your still, that is a bargain.
Right.
But take us from when you think of, you know what, I want to start distilling until this thing comes, you said, from Germany, right?
Yeah.
How long is that? I mean, did you know about, obviously there's some research, but did you know, like, okay, this is the still that I need to get?
Yeah.
How long is that process till you kind of open up?
So it has been a little over almost 5 years now since we started the process. And part of it was when I first started making wines, I made a lot of the Bordeaux varieties, Cabernet. And in Cabernet, you don't do as much of this bleeding process as you do with like the Rhone varieties, which if you know Paso Robles is a Rhone variety region. I mean, we're producing a lot of Syrahs and Mourvedres and Grenaches. And those varieties are really well suited for doing that bleeding because they tend to be bigger grapes. And so you want to reduce that amount of juice in the grapes to concentrate. And so about 5 years ago, I was like, oh, there's got to be something better to do with this. And that's when we got the idea. You know, we obviously started with the county. And are we allowed to do this? And went to the state and the federal government. You know, it was a whole process getting through, making sure it was actually legal to do. And to be honest, it's funny. I still get winemakers that walk in the winery and go, this can't be legal. There's no way you're doing
How
are you doing this? Because there's such a mystique around distilling. And they're like, there's no way that you can be doing it. And, but yeah, we went through the whole process. We actually hired a consultant to walk us through the whole process, and it was actually the first distillery that they had actually licensed, and so it was even work for them as the compliance people. They've done hundreds of wineries, but the first distillery. So we had to figure out just the functional amount of it. Had to decide on what still to use. And you know, it's actually funny, when we're sitting here tonight, and the theater next door, you said, has got a fly fishing
film festival.
So anyway, so I had to learn how to use a still, and that's, you know, challenge, because there's not a lot of distilleries around. And so I actually went up to Spokane, Washington, to Dry Fly Distilling, which is they're one of the earlier people in the game of distilling, and they actually were the ones who helped change the legislation in Washington to make it so that they could have tasting rooms just like wineries have tasting rooms. So I went up to Spokane and worked for about 10 days learning the whole process of distilling. And so the still I ended up deciding on was the same version that they had up there. They actually had two of them, and just a little bit smaller. So they had a 450-liter still. We actually have a 180-liter still. But it's the same design, same manufacturer over out of Germany. So had to figure out how to use it, had to figure out if it was legal, had to figure out how to convince my wife to basically invest in a still. And that actually was probably the hardest part. And so I finally broke down and took her up. There's a distillery up out of Alameda, St. George Spirits, And so I had been there before, but she hadn't been to it. And, you know, I finally said, okay, you just got to come check it out. You're just going to love it. And so walked in, did the whole tour, did the whole tasting. And she's like, okay, send him the check. So that took about 3.5 years. And then we got our license last August, and or 2 years ago, August now. So, so we've been making spirits for about a year and a half now.
That's,
I think it's,
that's a pretty quick learning curve, because this is, I mean, it's great.
Right. It's 10 days and then you're
well,
it's
interesting though, because, I jokingly say 10 days, but part of distilling is knowing when to, and what to keep and what to get rid of. I've been training for that for 20 years. You know, in wine, we look for spoilage in minute quantities. Distilling basically magnifies those things. And so when you're looking for ethyl acetate in wine, which is a major spoilage in wine, you're looking for traces of it that a consumer can pick up. When you're distilling it, it's like, you know, taking that nail polish off the shelf out of the Rite Aid, and you can just smell it. It's intense. Mm-hmm. And so making those cuts was made easier by the fact that, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years. It was almost academic at that point. And it used those kind of the senses of taste and smell, and, you know, basically in winemaking, you take notes and you follow through on everything you did, like beer making. I mean, it's, you follow that recipe and it becomes a routine. And distilling is very much like that. And so I think, you know, it didn't just take 10 days or 3 years to get here. Mm-hmm. It took 20 years to get here.
Years,
and that's what I think you're going to see in this whole distilling business.
It's so, just it's so much different than home brewing because, or commercial brewers, because you talk to them, they're like, "Wow, I was home brewing for 10 years at home, and you can't really distill at home, so it's not like something that you can."
Well, you're not supposed to distill at home.
I've seen stills for sale.
Talk about the coil in the bathtub.
But yeah, it's not something you can practice.
No, that's the problem. There's no threshold. I mean, it's legally you are not able to distill anything, and so yeah, unfortunately, it becomes kind of that hidden. Kind of secret thing that some people do, and it's a shame because it's definitely something that I think has its place. And you know, you think the government would figure it out too, because the revenue that they can get off of this is unreal. So you know, on a gallon of spirits, it's $13.50 in tax to the federal government. So, which is scary if you think about what you were drinking.
The tax was more than the
But yeah, so it's you know, so it's definitely a win-win for everybody. So,
well, we've got another one because you brought in the gin as well, and I'm trying to think. It looks like we got a couple minutes before the break, so if we get a taste of that, and then we can kind of tease into the break, and then come back from that and discuss going a little deeper on that one. So we've got a couple glasses here. Is this one, does that have some in there right there? All right. So tell us about what the difference is just in the distillation process between the vodka and the gin.
Absolutely. For all intents and purposes, a gin.
Okay. So that was my smell of this. This is, oh my word. This is
dangerous is a good word, I think.
Yes.
So for all intents and purposes, a gin, for all intents and purposes, is an infused vodka. And so we are starting with an incredible base material. And again, it gets back into my 20 years as a winemaker. A gin was fun for me because a gin, what you're doing is you're taking, you know, a huge kind of palette of botanicals and trying to narrow it down to something that just has some unique characteristics to it, but has that kind of underlying juniper that you expect gin to be. So I don't know how much you want me to go into gin now, because gin is a whole animal in itself. But gin has to be a juniper base. It has to have about 51% juniper as the base botanical. But there's no regulation on what else it can be. I mean, so we actually started with about 17 different botanicals, and we narrowed it down to 7 botanicals, which you're trying right now. And it's not just about the botanicals that you use, but how you use them, you know, whether you steep them, whether you vapor pass them, where you put them on the still. And so it really, when you start doing this type of infusion, it really kind of shows the craft, I think, a little bit more than where a vodka is really more of a process. Yes, you're making those cuts, but it is a little bit more academic than when you're really doing the blending, very much like winemaking. I mean, that's where really the craft comes in, and that's the exciting part for me.
I mean, I would love to, when we come back from the break, touch on gin, because I do like gin, and I understand botanicals, but I don't understand how it all comes together to be gin.
Right, and I'm tantalized by you just kind of teasing us that you've got these, that you're putting these herbs, whatever, in these different, as it's distilling up and through these things. So that sounds like it's going to be, I'm really looking forward to this, and I can say right now that my wife is probably just like kicking me right now, because this is, gin is one of her favorite drinks too, and this is by far the best gin that I've had. And I mean, I'm not a big gin drinker, and I like Hendrick's, and I like some other ones, but this is just fantastic. So
we'll go to break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about gin for sure with Alex from Refined Distillery.
Yeah, give his website a look out for sure.
Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis on mybuzzradio.com.
You're listening to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis.
A little lounge music. fantastic.
That was perfect for what we're drinking.
I know, just sitting back with my little snifter of gin. It's all good. So tonight is definitely a we're driving night. We're driving is my my driving service that I take home after every show, and they make sure that I get home safe and sound. So you can make reservations or just give them a call out of the blue. And but it's so great because they come with two drivers. One of them gets in the car, it gets in your car with you. They drive you home, and then they turn around and go pick up some other people that shouldn't be driving. And just last week, I follow them all week long, and last weekend they had something like over the weekend several hundred calls where they were driving people back and forth, and that's several hundred DUIs and drunk people that were off the roads. I mean, it's just great. And so sitting here enjoying boutique vodkas and boutique gins that are just you know, where you could fill up a pint glass, I think, and just sit back and enjoy these.
Sounds like a plan.
Without even realizing what you're doing. I mean, that's great. So go to weredriving.com, weredriving.com, and take a look at them. They work out of Oxnard. And
Ventura, Oxnard.
How far do they go?
I've heard Paso? Santa Barbara. I've heard Staples Center. I don't know if that's
yeah,
true.
Yeah. So they'll go to LA Staples Center. They'll go to LA.
Paso. I don't know about Paso. We could ask
if you're willing to pay the price to get there. I'm sure that they would do it. So they're open till late. I mean, they take calls.
Yeah, they don't sleep. I thought I worked late, but these guys work really late.
Yeah, they take calls up to like 3 a.m. So they're all about getting people home. And what's really great too is I met the owner Israel and his wife. I had lunch with them a couple months ago. And it's just these two. He was a trucker, and the trucking business laid him off. He said, "What am I going to do? Well, I know how to drive." And so this is what they did. They started this company, getting people home safe every night. So
there's drunk people in Ventura, and I know how to drive.
Right. I know. So it was a win-win for everyone. So welcome back to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis. We are broadcasting from mybuzzradio.com. If you're listening to us right now, you already know that. But if you're listening to the podcast, give us a look and look for some of our older shows as well. So we've got Alex from Refined Distillery out of Paso Robles. And
we were just getting into gin right before the break, and we had to cut Alex off, unfortunately. But
right.
Botanicals. Yeah. And gin and distilling. I saw a picture one time of, I think it might have been, you know, at Bombay, and they had a whole table full of botanicals. It was like, so I think they claim they have like 20 something in their sapphire, but it was just amazing to see all these different things that went into the gin. But I think what I don't understand, admittedly, is when do they go into the gin, or how, where, mm-hmm. you know, it's not infused in the sense of like taking a vodka and sticking something in it and letting it
like
soak up
bag.
The flavor like a tea.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it so it is an infusion, but it's actually, for us, it's actually a vapor infusion. But to get to that point, we actually had to do a little experimentation, because when you're actually doing that infusion, we have a relatively small volume, and you could basically say, I think I want this in there, or I think I want that in there. But we had to come up with your basic formula. And to do that, what we did is we actually took little mason jars with the little tea bags, basically, and we soaked 17 different botanicals in 65% alcohol. And we took a lot of the traditional ones from Bombay, from Hendrix, from a couple other the gins that I liked. And everybody's happy to tell you what goes into their gin.
Right.
They're just not going to tell you a lot of times the percentage or how they put them in, because that's kind of your trade secret. And so we took 17 different botanicals. We took a couple local things that the only thing that made it in local was our lavender, because we grow a lot of lavender up there. It's one of the few things the deer don't eat. So we
got an easy source.
Yeah, one of the things actually we're playing around right now, and it's going to have to be a seasonal, is almond blossom, because almonds are basically what Paso Robles is actually, you know, it used to be a huge almond and walnut growing area. Oh. And so we wanted to kind of pull in some of that heritage from Paso. But what we did is we started with 17 different botanicals. We had them soaking in the alcohol. And then we played around just like we would as a wine. We knew it had to be at least 51% juniper. And so we just started putting our blend together. We started with the juniper. We knew we wanted a little citrusy. We knew we wanted a little floral. We wanted some neat kind of earthy qualities to it. And so we just started playing around with different proportions of each until we reached this rough blend versus from our steeped infusion. That gave us basically a recipe to put in the still. So we weren't just throwing darts at a wall hoping we'd come up with a good recipe. This is probably our third batch that we've done through the still. So a batch might be more than one distillation, but it's the third basically set that we've done. And we've tweaked it a little bit each time, just because each time, you know, the first time it was a little too heavy on the lavender, because lavender actually puts a lot of aromatics into it with very little volume. And so we've played around with the different amounts of lavender. Also, location, I think I mentioned before the break, that where you put things in the still actually makes a difference in a gin as well. And so each still is going to be a little bit different, and juniper might react differently depending on your still, if it's closer to the heat or farther away from the heat. In some cases, it'll bring out more of a piney characteristic versus kind of a more traditional junipery characteristic to it. And so depending on what you want, some people like that kind of piney gin. Personally, I like it kind of a little bit on the more mellow side. And so we had to play around and work with our still to figure out where we put the botanicals, how close to the heat, and how much of each botanical to really make the gin. Our gin is virtually identical to what our vodka is for the first three distillations. It's on that fourth distillation where we actually do the vapor infusion to create the gin. And so both products that we produce are four times distilled. Three of them are identical distillations, and then it's the fourth distillation that really separates the two products. As I said, for all intents and purposes, ours is an infused vodka. It doesn't have to be that in that case. Actually, in Europe, your base alcohol before you do the infusion has to be 95% or higher, so it legally has to be a vodka first. In the United States, your base alcohol only has to have gotten up to about 65% before you infuse it.
Okay.
We're treating it more like a vodka than we're using more the European style. And for me, the reason is a couple different things. One, I want that really purity of alcohol because I think it gives us a better product. But then also because we're dealing with grapes are pretty flavorful, and if we only went to 65%, it could actually be more brandy-esque or eau de vie-esque than gin. And to be honest, I don't mind a little bit of it kind of coming through, but I really want it to be, a gin. That's really kind of the important thing. But the important thing about using the grapes is, again, you're using that good base material. You have really clean, you have that beautiful kind of mouthfeel that I was talking about with the vodka, that kind of sweetness and that the way it coats your mouth. It gives you a chance to really taste all the botanicals. I jump over. If you can't tell, I get excited about this stuff. But
it's
that's
perfect.
Okay.
It's perfect because I'm just sitting back here enjoying and going, oh, yeah.
So We started with 17 botanicals. And you look at Bombay and they got this huge grouping of different botanicals. And, for me, the way this coats your mouth, when I used too many different botanicals, it muddied the water a little bit. And so we settled back on 7 different botanicals because we wanted it to be a little bit cleaner. We wanted that complexity, but we wanted you to be able to really kind of, at different points when you're actually, it's lingering in your mouth, you can go, oh, there is the, the citrus. Oh, there's the orris root. Oh, there's the grains of paradise. And so you can really kind of actually pull this thing apart and really kind of taste those flavors, where sometimes if you get too many, they kind of block each other out. And so we started originally with lots of things, and we just kept backing off. And I say we, it was actually another winemaker friend of mine. And so it actually was fun to have two winemakers working on the blend. And so we finally settled on these seven different characteristics to it. And we're really looking for, those kind of neat floral and citrusy and kind of junipery notes. And that orris root, which I mentioned, that was a kind of a unique one. And I think Sapphire has orris root, and it's actually an iris root. And it's got a neat kind of characteristic to it.
I mean, as a winemaker, you definitely had that blending background for sure, right? You're trying individual, whether it be vintages or you're trying individual barrels. So it's really cool to see how your winemaking is always playing part in your in the distilling. Yeah. And because otherwise it's like you're trying 7 different things, or 17 different things actually, and then you have to pick how do these 7 work together. Did it take you... You said you made a couple until you kind of tweaked it. Is that kind of how it went? Like, okay, now that we know how it tastes in the individual, now we make one batch and see how that comes together. You kind of go back to the drawing board and keep going?
Yeah, so we actually did a couple dry runs in smaller volumes to make sure it was close to what we did in our original mock-up, I guess you would call it. But then, you know, each batch we have tweaked around. So we will, you know, the first batch we tried it and, you know, it was a fantastic gin, but we kind of mellowed out the lavender a little bit and we've tweaked it each time. I got to be honest, I think we're pretty darn close here. And the only thing I might actually do, like I was saying, was a seasonal, maybe add something in like an almond blossom or something kind of unique to that characteristic that way.
Right.
But the other, one of the government things that you have to do is you have to file a formula for everything you do. And so if I change things around too much, I have to file a formula with the federal government before I actually change my gin.
So the government has your formula for this gin?
The government has my formula. The nice thing about it, they do let you have a range, but if I wanted to add something brand new in, I would have to go back and refile my formula. So, but they do have the formula for this. So.
Is that a secret? Are they good at keeping that secret? Is that?
Well, after 30 years, I think it's declassified. So.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah,
is that, but we've got a, what, we have another 28 years to go before we get to find out what's in.
But then I'll change it on you.
Right. So, beer and wine too. Well, wine, obviously, vintage to vintage. Beer, batch to batch. Especially the true hardcore beer geeks are like, they did something different on this batch. It's not the same as, you know, batch number 12. And is that the same in distilling? Or how close can you get? You have a recipe,
yeah,
right? And how close can we get to that? Because with beer, you can try to follow that recipe exactly, and there may be some variables that you just can't control.
Yeah.
Or maybe your malt bill, maybe the wheat you got, the malt you got was a little less than it was the last time, and then here's a little. Right?
Unless you're some sort of multinational conglomerate giant brewing organization.
You're going to have variables, all the time.
Than otherwise.
No, that's exactly it. So in the winery, vintage to vintage, there's going to be lots of changes. If you're a huge winery, what you're going to do is you're going to blend those variations away.
Right.
As a small winery, we don't. We basically try to highlight those vintage characteristics.
Sure.
And so you're going to basically see stellar wines of certain varieties when a year focuses on that variety. And we're going to try to maximize each one. It's the same thing with the spirits. In a small batch, there's always going to be a small amount of variation in a product like a gin. In a vodka, not so much, because there's a consistency of base material. But, you know, if your juniper is, has a little bit more oil than it did the previous year, or, you know, your lavender is, you know, a little fresher, or it's from a different region, you're definitely going to pick up those different characteristics. And I say different region. It could be from like Paso to San Luis Obispo, and you're going to get a different characteristic. We're trying to keep everything as local as we can. But, you know, even within miles, you get different characteristics. And there is going to be that batch-to-batch change, but I got to be honest, I think that's the kind of the cool thing about it.
That's the craft aspect.
Yeah,
right,
absolutely
there.
It is. Yeah. And that's, and people are, I think, starting to accept that as well, you know. And so with craft beer, some of the bigger breweries, you know, and especially even some of the local ones, when I have a County Line Rye, I want it to taste like County Line Rye. But I know that there's going to be subtle differences from batch to batch. And here, that's one of the things that makes it so great, is that it's still, you can look forward to still a great tasting beverage, and then, but then just enjoying whatever the nuances are from batch to batch.
Yeah, no, and that's going to be the fun thing, and to see it evolve. And I think people are becoming knowledgeable enough about spirits that they look forward to that. And, and they look forward to coming in and saying, oh, I hear you got a new batch coming out, or, you know, you have this new product.
Let me try your newest one.
Yeah.
Do you find people at the tasting room coming and going, whoa, don't give me gin. I don't like gin. I mean, Curtis mentioned earlier, like, we were jokingly saying that, you know, he loved it. He wasn't really a big fan of gin. Do you find that at the tasting room where people are coming in and going, oh, I don't want to try that, thank you. But then you're like, no, try it.
Yeah,
and
no.
Does it change their mind?
I got to be honest. It's amazing how many people walk out with a bottle of the gin.
Yeah.
Because they're just like, wow, that's not what I expected. Gin is one of those kind of, I think, misunderstood spirits. It, you know, it got a bad reputation for good reasons. One of the things in distilling is you're really starting, it's a volumes game a little bit. You're starting with a lot of material and you're distilling it down to a smaller amount of material. And in that process, you're getting rid of some of the bad alcohols. The great thing about juniper is it's got an incredible aromatic character, but it also has the ability to mask bad alcohols, so some of those aromas that you don't want. But with juniper in there, you can actually leave a little bit in it. Those bad alcohols are not good for your system. And so that's why gin has gotten that reputation as being that kind of drink that makes you go crazy. Because you can leave some of that bad alcohol and it does make people go crazy. But, you know, with with these craft spirits that you're starting to see pop up, I think ours definitely shows that you can produce a gin that is just so clean and you know, is every bit as nice as like a really well done vodka, and is easy to drink like that, and it doesn't give you that hangover in the morning either.
Yeah, that's an important thing. We want to get up and be able to function the next day. You're in Paso. Can we go to the tasting room as a customer? People are listening. Can they go and visit you guys and taste some of these until they can see them at their local bar and shop? How do we find you guys?
Yeah, no, we actually do have a tasting room. We are actually on pretty much all of the local maps. The Regional Association, the Paso Robles Wine Country Alliance, has a great map that covers most of the tasting rooms in the area. We have our wine tasting room, and the tasting room for the spirits is right in front of the in front of the still itself. The cool thing that you get to see is we're running that still probably 7 days a week, and so you get to see the process taking place right in front of your eyes as you're tasting the spirits. And you also get, we try to separate out the cuts so you can actually try the heads, hearts, and tails right there. So you can really, you can understand the process a little bit better. Because when you're talking about it, sometimes it's hard to kind of really kind of conceptualize what's going on. But when there's a glass of heads, women try it and go, hey, that's nail polish remover. They don't try it. They smell it. That's all you need to do. And so it's a great experience to actually come and kind of see what's going on instead of just kind of buying it from a store shelf. I mean, it's very much like wine. When you can actually see what's going on, see where it's coming from. And, you know, I'm there pouring. You know, my assistant distiller is there. He's pouring. You know, it is a working distillery winery. We are working, you know, and if somebody walks in the door, we shift gears and we go over and we pour them the wine and the spirits. And so it's a fun experience to come up and check out. We're just up on Adelaida Road, which Adelaida Road is just kind of in the northwest kind of corner of Paso Robles. And we've been there as a winery in that location now for 10 years. And there's, you know, probably another dozen wineries on Adelaida Road itself, and it's fun. It's a great area to come visit. We have great restaurants, great hotels. It's a lovely
yeah,
place to come
awesome.
Visit.
Yeah. And are you guys open every day?
We are actually currently open Thursday through Sunday, but I'm saying that. Coming by the end of March, after the Zin Festival weekend, which is the third weekend in March, we are actually going to 7 days a week. We have so many people coming in the driveway, and they get disappointed when we're not open. Yeah. We finally kind of said, you know, we're here anyway. We're working. We might as well just go ahead and tell everybody we're open 7 days a week. So come end of March, 7 days a week.
Well, I thank you for that. You know,
yeah, Curtis and I mean, separately or together, we like to visit places like Monday or Tuesday.
Right, yeah, just and when you don't
you guys
have,
can come anytime you want.
All right, well,
when you don't have a talk. But I was just thinking, you know, so I learned of Alex and Refine through the California help me out with it.
California Distillers Guild.
Okay. So and I was just looking through it and I said, oh, let me, here are these people that I never knew about. So I contacted them through that. So before I even realized you were a winery. So we'll have to have you back on as a winery as well, too. I mean, just to talk about whatever your I guess, flagship style. That's not style for wine. What is it? Your
varietal.
Varietal. Thank you. That's what I was trying to.
But Alex was saying earlier that you guys are, you don't have your wine in stores or.
We actually have a few locations, to be honest, because we've had our winery now for close to 20 years. Most of our wine is sold directly through the tasting room or through our wine club. And, you know, to be honest, we were a small winery. You know, one of those lifestyle decisions. You know, we were talking about this earlier. There are 7,000 wineries in the U.S. Compared to, 250 distilleries right now. Trivia fact, pre-prohibition, there were actually 8,000 distilleries. And so
that's crazy.
Yeah, I totally forgot to bring it up. Thanks for bringing it up.
Right.
Yeah. That blew me away. That's the only thing that there is actually less of than before prohibition.
Absolutely. So because there's so many wineries out there, my wife and I really made that decision that, you know, we have young kids. We decided we didn't want to go out there and basically fight to sell the wines when, you know, we were already having pretty good success with people coming to us. And so we decided to stay small on the winery side, you know, when our kids are young. Now as our kids are getting a little older, we're ready to get out there. And the spirits is the perfect kind of way to kind of to enter that distribution venue. So,
well, we're happy and delighted to have you here for sure. We've just got a few minutes left.
Yeah, we're getting our last call here, Curtis. So in honor of having Alex here and his distilling, I thought we're doing the Schneider Aventinus, which is a great Weizenbach. If you've never had their Hef or their Weizenbach or any of their beers, outstanding. Mm-hmm. But this is their spirit distilled from grain. So we've been talking recently, or I mean recently, this whole show about distilling. This is essentially starts off as their Aventinus Weizenbach, and then they distill it. And just even when I poured it, I could smell it when I was pouring it to you guys. The aromatics on this are insane. I mean, it's
right. Lovely. Well, I was expecting the I thought you were pouring the vodka again because it was still in this. And I held it and I brought it to my nose. And I, oh my word! There's the fruit sweetness in here.
Yeah.
And it's I haven't had a sip of it yet, but it smells great. So while you guys are taking your sip there, I was looking at the Facebook page. We got a couple people, two people who shared, and they were both women. So they're in good shape. Vicky Stobley and Kathleen Taylor. Kathleen Taylor also happens to be my mother. So
you gotta love that.
So I'm stoked about that because I'm guessing that T-shirt's gonna come down to her daughter-in-law. So that's. I'm okay with that. So, if it's okay, we'll keep the other two and then the mints, and then we'll end up we'll hand those out down the road to as we keep building our listenership, and these little giveaways are going to be prized possessions. Oh, I can tell already.
I just want to say cheers, Alex.
Oh yeah, cheers
for our last call here.
Cheers,
cheers, Alex. Thanks for coming in. And I've always been a beer guy, and just probably because I could just go I have such a checkered past with spirits. And so I never seek them out or even try them. And that's one of the things that I love about this show is that it's just totally opening up this whole other aspect of liquor for me, which is, you know, which is great in and of itself. So, and just pointing out that, you know, vodka doesn't have to be harsh and doesn't have to feel like glass going down your throat when you're doing it at the same time.
One thing I wanted to ask Alex, this reminds me of the beer a lot actually, because it has like that banana and some of those flavors. Yeah. When you're distilling, do a lot of those flavors, they do carry over? Do they get amplified or they just kind of...
Oh, they most definitely do. And so that's why I think when you actually have a good beer that you're distilling, it's fantastic. We actually are kind of a teaser. One of the reasons I actually found out about this, I'm a big whiskey and bourbon fan, and so we're actually doing some experimentation with one of the local breweries, and we actually did a rye wheat barley beer that we actually distilled. And I got to be honest, it was just unbelievable being in the distillery when we were actually distilling it, because the aromas in the winery were just over the top. And so it's fun to actually have that stuff coming across. And so we've experimented with this. We've experimented with an apple. We've actually done a blueberry. And the aromas are so intense because you are concentrating it. And so if you like aromas, kind of on steroids at that point.
Yeah. Some of the German ones.
Well, and when you're talking about these intensified aromas and everything, it reminds me of the beer I had this evening, which was an Eisbach, which is where they've got their Bock beer and then they freeze it and then they take all the water out, which just is concentrating all those malt flavors. And so anyone who has that kind of experience in a beer sense, where it has been, you know, the liquid has been pulled out and these flavors have been intensified, that's what we're talking about. And in the distillery, you know, anything that's left on that is going to be just an intense flavor all the way, because you're pulling out all of the water that's diluting it.
Yeah.
So it's perfect. I love the intense flavors and the excitement about... and other people's excitement about these aromas and these flavors that are coming out of these drinks as well.
This doesn't finish nearly as smooth as your vodka.
It doesn't finish as smooth.
That's okay, because it was like the beer is an intense beer that I started with, but
right, it does.
And now I know why. That's part of the distilling process. So it's probably something
they're wanting to keep some of those characteristics.
Keep some of that in there.
Yeah. So I mean, that's a distilling choice. And so it's very much like unaged whiskey, to be honest.
Right.
And so they're trying to keep some of those heads and tails intact, because that's where a lot of those flavor compounds are. And so that's the kind of the neat thing you're seeing, is you're seeing crafted spirits, not just something that's done automated by a computer. So,
yeah, on the exhale on this, you can get the ghost of the beer past, you know, and that's really, it's a nice warm kind of feeling That comes through, but you can definitely get like the malt flavors that are hiding, the malt sweetness anyway, that's hiding there. So we got about a minute left here in the show. We've got another show coming up next week. Can you imagine that?
If this week's show was next week's show, that would be interesting.
Right, because next week we have Captain Aguilar from Ventura Police Department, from the Sheriff's Department, and he's going to be coming in, and it's kind of like our PSA for the year, and so he's going to be in giving us breathalyzers as we go through the show.
So we're not actually trying to get drunk. I think the point is that we're just going to drink as normal and see, like, what happens to our breathalyzer scores.
Right, and I think I'm pretty in tune to my alcohol sensing, you know, and it doesn't take much. I mean, I can enjoy these beers, but I know that after a beer, and especially on an empty stomach, I'm not driving, you know, I can feel it. Of course, those are generally 14% beers that I'm drinking, but I don't think other people, I think people just think, yeah, I've had one beer, it's okay to go. No, if you're feeling buzzed, it's not okay to go. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun with Captain Aguilar here, giving us breathalyzers as we go through the show. I would be interested in tonight, and I mean, we've been enjoying these too, but I have a nice warm glow, and I know that there's no way that I could drive home safe. And then after that, we have LA Ale Works. It's a brand new brewery that they're doing a Kickstarter program in LA, obviously, and they're trying to raise money to open up a new brewery in Los Angeles. So
yeah, it's really cool. So they just came out with their first beers.
They're contract brewing, right, and they're trying to open up their own space. So
it's really cool.
So we'll get to probably get to taste a couple beers on that, and then after that we've got kind of an open spot, but we're in talks to get some people filled in on those in those spaces. So we've got a lot of fun shows coming up, and they're going to be 90 minutes. So folks, when we start from here on out, that's your warning that you go to the bathroom before you sit down and start listening to the show, because you're not getting up for a while.
Or grab a nice gin martini.
Or a martini.
Alex, thank you so much for joining us. I learned a lot and had fun in tasting your spirits. Your website is up on our thing, but it's refineddistillery.com. Definitely check it out. Is there somewhere on there that will say where to get the stuff for pretty soon?
Yeah, so we'll actually be, once we actually start getting some locations here in California that are going to be carrying our spirits, we'll definitely have those links up there. But obviously you can order it directly from us as well. And so you can get it right on our website, and look forward to coming back down.
Fantastic.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us on Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis on mybuzzradio.com.
And we'll see you next week.
You're listening to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis.